להיאבק על זה, וכאו את זה. All right, this is a big, take notes like mad today, right? Because this, we're jumping around a lot. And I'm adding stuff. I'll send you a list of the page numbers at some point. But what I say about it, you need to be here. Okay. It struck me that I hardly had enough stuff to put on the final exam. So I thought I'd do kind of a survey here of the transition from the medieval period to the Renaissance. So I'm going to add some short poems and stuff. Some people wanted a little more taste of just English poetry than I had planned. The Rabelais just wasn't singing to me. It just seemed like a little long and heavy for you guys right now, and I wasn't in the mood for getting into that. So there'll be alterations on the syllabus, but I'll try and make it clear eventually, all right? If you didn't get your exam, you'd see me after class. I still even have a couple of papers here. So is there any question on anything else? Paper, life, whatever? All right. Did you like the Boccaccio story last time? It seemed slightly more accessible than I like. It wasn't obscure or anything. I thought maybe we'd do another one, just so you can, because I want to make a little point. So let's turn to page, and we're going to read one more story around the classroom, and then I'll jump into this other stuff. And that story is on page 1631. Boccaccio is just a storyteller. The point I'm going to make is, when we get done with this, we're going to do a little bit of the Canterbury Tales. This kind of thing, you got to follow me on this, right? You are responsible for the Canterbury Tales first lines tape, no matter how much I get to it, right? So if I ask you who wrote the Canterbury Tales, you'll say Geoffrey Chaucer, right? If I say something, what did Geoffrey Chaucer write, you will know it's the Canterbury Tale. Chaucer was an English poet, but his source was Boccaccio. Boccaccio was writing in about 1370, about two generations after Dante, and it was really just a whole new world. Dante is fully medieval. God is the center of everything Dante does. And Boccaccio comes along really 50, 70 years later, and it's just different, right? And this little story we're going to do shows you the difference. It's secular, it's entertaining, it's a funny story, it's about sex. Okay, Dante would have turned in his grave. Okay. But it's just a story. What I don't have time really to do in this class is to show you how, as you move into English, English literature is one of the wonders of the world. There's just no doubt about it. It's not just because we happen to speak English, right? But they were a literary nation. There are some nations that aren't, but there were just a lot of really good writers in England, right? Shakespeare, you know, leaps to mind, all right? So and if I go to France, I say, who's your Shakespeare? They say, well, we do not have a Shakespeare. England has a, nobody at that level. But what the English do is they add character to plot. Remember those things in Aristotle, plot, character? And I don't really have time to go through this, but in Boccaccio, we'll notice in this story, the people are just sort of cardboard figures. And what Chaucer would do is take them and give them a background, tell you what books they read, okay, what color their hair is, and stuff like that. Yeah, hop out, come back. It's all on tape. You can pick it up later. I'll see if it's, still working, yeah. Lose too much. So one of the things, the points I want to get across is the transition from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. Right? Middle Ages is a period of, and I'll just give you the general view. Usually people are not individuals. They're all part of an institution. Everybody's locked into their position, their job. There's no real internal search. Art is really about God, right? And the Renaissance comes along, really changes things. It loosens things up, and suddenly God is not the center of your life. I mean, not that he doesn't exist, but the individual becomes much more important. People are suddenly individual people. And we usually see this expression in the great artists. Now, we have fairly decent medieval art, but, you know, Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci are Renaissance people. They're really expressing themselves rather than a corporate idea. Okay. Now, Boccaccio sort of got one foot in the Middle Ages, so when Chaucer changes him, he'll add character, individuality to his protagonist. But that's not to berate Boccaccio, so let's just have some fun with this and read it. So at least I know you know two stories. Where did I leave off? Who was the last person to read last time? Did you read? Caitlin, did you? Are you on page 1631? Not long ago. Are you with me?
Not long ago, there was a valley.
You know me. Pinuccio, yeah. Okay. Why doesn't he want anybody to know that he's hot for this girl? Doesn't want to get in trouble. He doesn't really plan to marry her. Absolutely. Why not? She's poor, he's rich. Okay, different social class. Her father is a worthy man who runs a little inn way out in the country, north of Florence, nowheresville. All right, it's like owning a, I don't know what. Name some small Indiana town. Take your pick. Okay, you know, like, he is said to be a young Florentine gentleman, and that is a status term. That means he's wealthy, all right? So he sees this beautiful girl, but she's not in his social class, but that's not stopping him, all right? Well, also, he's a rather dumb guy, too. We're on page 1631, too. We'll skip over here. What are you, Katie? No. What? Lisa, yeah. Lisa Burke. Right. At length, his ardor is a word we don't usually see, ardor, my passion, my heat. Actually, it's from the Greek word for arrow, like a little cupid arrow, the ardor. Conversant. Okay, we'll see, this guy's rather dull, but he seems to know what he wants. He sets out the house, and the layout of the house is going to be very important here. When it says he has a longing to consort with her, what does consort mean? Consorts thou Romeo me? Yeah, I think it's a euphemism, all right? Okay, he wants to consort with her. Translator's probably picking it up from Shakespeare, because I don't know if you remember, Tybalt comes into the town square and says, Romeo, thou consorts with, Mercutio, thou consorts with Romeo. And Mercutio says, you don't ever use the word consort with me, Jack. You know, pull that a sword. Like, consort is a really bad word. That's something musicians would do. They would consort together. All right, let's go ahead. Late one afternoon. Oh, okay. Go ahead. Adriano. Unione. Romagna, it's a northern district. Canuccio. Okay, when he says he wrote up to the cottage of our worthy friend, who's he talking about? And why does he say our worthy friend? Yeah, it's the father, it's the poor guy. But this is the narrator of the story sort of stepping in, right? And it's being told by an aristocratic, I think it's one of the guys is telling this story. So it's kind of condescending, right? Our worthy friend is ironic because, in fact, the father is in a lower social class. So you don't really need, that's not that important, but just do the next paragraph. Okay, so he makes up a story about, you know, got it, you got to put us up for the night, right? And we've already been told the guy, it's a very small house, and he doesn't like to put people up, but he knows this person, right? So, four. Okay, so who's sleeping in which bed? This is the whole point of the story. I don't, the husband and the wife are in one, and the daughter's in another. She's alone. The baby's in a cradle next to the parents' bed, and the two guys are in the same bed. Why are they in the same bed? What? So this should just be banned at Purdue? No? Perfectly normal at the time. I mean, right up to the 20th century, people normally slept two to the bed. Okay, there just weren't that many beds around. It was quite customary. You know, just deal with it. Right? You're lucky to get a bed at all. Sometimes three. Right? You watch a really good cowboy movie to put a lot of guys in there. Okay. So I don't think there's no funny overtones or anything here. It's just perfectly normal. Okay. When I was 18 and I was my first summer job, we was selling door to door. We went to sales school in Nashville, four of us to a room, two beds. You know, it's perfectly normal. You save money. So that's all that's going on here. All right, go ahead, Laura. I noticed she didn't scream. Okay, this is not really a story about this girl and her motives or anything else. She's there. He hops in, and they seem to know what to do. Read the next one. Who got up? Okay. How come the guy didn't get up? Well, we don't know yet, but she'll sort of tell us. He's obviously a heavier sleeper than she is. Okay. You know, I think my point, right now, this is the plot. The characters don't really enter in, but little things happen. Like a good storyteller, right? You got the cradle in the right place, the cat comes out of nowhere to knock something over, the right person will get up, all right? And watch what she does. So it's just sort of musical chairs. This is a master storytelling, okay, that we have here. But not what we would call a study in character. Just a study in the story. It's really plot, okay? And that's my point. So go ahead, Melinda. Who moved the cradle?
Adriana.
Why? Yeah, I mean, no deep motives here. It's just is in the way. Okay, there's no plot. There's no moral action at all. Okay, it's just stuff happens, though. Right? I mean, nobody's really thinking this through. Andrew, go ahead.
I'm perceiving
this?
I'm perceiving that Adriana is still awake.
Tacked heart to windward. That's a sailing term. That's from sailing. I'm not sure how it fits here, but it's on the same dictionary as consort. All right. Go ahead. Okay, so this guy's a real jerk because he's like bragging right away. It's not even, and then he's I'll leave it to you to decide whether he's exaggerating or not. Okay. So, go ahead. Here, let's go around the corner. Okay, now that's a really difficult line as you're reading the story. Clearly, he said to this guy, I just slept with your daughter. And the guy says, why have you played me such a trick? Then, like, stab him to death right on the spot. So we have to sort of just assume the character goes with the story. Right? No real person would talk like this. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Next, you who are hardly recognized. You are. You know, just reach over there and read with somebody. Just lean over. So how do we analyze this? How do we think about this? All right. Suppose you were putting this in your essay on women in literature or whatever. Who's the sort of key figure here? The mother, all right. What does she do that's remarkable? She cheats and lies and she gets away with it, okay? But she's not vicious, she's just going along with her situation. She didn't plot it out. But having been put in her situation, she's the one who realizes what's going on. And so the key there is right in the middle of 1633. It's the moment of recognition. I mean, Aristotle only told us two things about plots, all right? He said very little. But usually there's a moment of recognition, okay, where people realize, aha, I think I mentioned this with Oedipus, right? Oh my God, that's my mother? That's what I call a recognition. Okay, you go from ignorance to knowledge, okay? And the other thing is a reversal of fortune, okay? So she recognizes what's going on and starts to tell the lies that she's been sleeping with her daughter, okay? And she seems to know how to handle her husband, who's dumb enough to believe the whole thing. Okay, and Adriano seconds her. jumps in and adds the bit about the sleepwalking to make the lie even better and more believable. So the four fathers got two people, three. The daughter doesn't seem to say anything. Pinuccio finally catches on, right? So the father's dumb. Pinuccio's pretty dumb, but he under the tutelage of the mother and his best friend, he finally, gets a little education and knows enough to follow along, which is a very fascinating Renaissance plot, the education of young men by experienced women. This is the plot in most Shakespeare comedies, right? And most of his great plays. That's why he's really so remarkable. It's the women are always teaching the young men how to behave. No, don't do that. Do this. That's not the way you ask a girl to dance, something like that. No, Romeo, I'm not going, don't swear by the moon. Just stand over there and promise you'll marry me. Okay? Okay. This goes on in play after play, but it's a very Renaissance thing. Right? Because, again, the Boccaccio was the breakthrough. He's really writing for a female audience to a certain extent. Is there a reversal here? This is not the key to the plot, but does anybody go from good fortune to bad fortune or bad fortune to good fortune? Yeah, David? Pinuccio certainly gets what he wants. Okay, so yeah, is it connected with the recognition? Aristotle says it's best when it's connected with the recognition. No, but it happens. How about the mother? Good to bad? Okay, she sort of is potentially in big trouble if her husband finds out she's over in the other bed with Adriano, okay? But then again, she seems to have more fun than she's getting most of the time with the old husband. So you could say she's going from bad fortune, sort of bad, crummy life to, good fortune. He doesn't seem to come back to her, though, later on, although Pinuccio comes back to the daughter. Anyway, that's a funny story. If you want to compare that to the Reeves tale in Chaucer, you can do that. Let's take a little look at my tape. On the Canterbury Tales. Again, Chaucer, the English poet in 1400, is really learning his storytelling from Boccaccio. He translates some of his stories. He uses them quite a bit. We don't need to get into details here. But just remember that Boccaccio wrote in Italian. He's from Italy. He lived in Florence. And Chaucer is an Englishman living in London about 30 years later. Oh, I got to turn on this thing, don't I? Now, the Canterbury Tales is a framed story. We talked about it before. It's just like the 1001 Arabian Nights. But the Arabian Nights is only one storyteller. In Boccaccio's Decameron, there's 10 different storytellers. Each tell 10 stories on 10 different days. 7 women, 3 men. Chaucer changes the emphasis from plot to character. Each of his storytellers represents a different social type of person. They all have very different personalities. These 26 pilgrims who go from, they meet in London and they journey to Canterbury to go to the shrine of Thomas à Becket. And on the way, according to this frame story, they tell stories. But each one tells a story appropriate to his or her situation. There's a knight, and he tells the knight's tale. So it's about love and chivalry, okay? Then there's a drunken miller, and he tells a really scurvy tale about a reeve who's an estate agent or something like that. And then the reeve tells the story about a drunken miller. So the lowlife guys go after each other. There's the famous wife of Bath who's been married 5 times. So she tells a story about how women should control men. Let's see if I can get this. So let's just watch this. And there's a prologue, which you're not reading a lot of this, but you're reading the introduction. And it's very poetic, and it's very kind of poetic. So let's see what it's about. So these are the first lines that you have them in your book, maybe slightly different. This is a modern version. So in April, people go on pilgrimages because it's spring and this is in Middle English, not Old English, not Modern English, Middle English. Just when French was ceasing to be spoken in England. Great vowel shift. Notice. So vowels are pronounced like in Spanish or something. Then there's this shift, the great vowel shift around 1400, 1450. April becomes April. Rida becomes ride. So this is sweet showers.
Oh, send it. Unbother everybody and switch the cooler.
I think we might be able to follow that. Go ahead.
A rich virtue in John Green is a fool.
Okay, what is a virtue? That sounds like a difficult word in this part.
Yeah. We have a non-English word, virtue, which is the ability to do something good. But in its root meaning, it means ability. Right? So the power. We would translate it through which power the flower is engendered. It's beautiful. It speaks to the heart. Well, the opening lines, if you look at them, it's one long sentence. And there's astrological imagery, there's the imagery of spring, I mean, Zephyrus, but that's the wind. But then they mention in the Ram, okay, that the sign of the Ram there. It's the first, the Ram is the first sign of the zodiac in the solar year. But the imagery of the falling rain, and then the emergent flowers, and then the quest of pilgrimage, contributes all of that to Genesis, the creation of the world. Oh, yes. But his poetry is rich in different allusions. He also read Ovid. It is in recreation. Well, this opening line is going to lead up to a point where the speaker is telling about his night at the inn, where he meets 29 pilgrims, and they're about to go on a journey to the Shrine of St. Thomas. He was mentioned, you know, the Holy Ghost beyond, the Holy Spirit, and on that journey. They want to be renewed, body, soul, healed, and the journey is pointed toward a specific shrine, candidate, but ultimately toward the eternal shrine of heaven. It's related to our words of Halloween, Halloween in Old English is holy,
okay.
And the hallways are the shrines, the holy places. He was daring, writing in English, not in Latin, nor in French. And and what we see in the opening lines are borrowings from Latin and diction, French, and it's interwoven with words with an Anglo-Saxon view. And with it becomes that there comes a different essential pattern. It's more of a rising rhythm, da-da, as opposed to the falling rhythm that you had in Anglo-Saxon. The general prologue of the Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer. One but often with the shore sofa, the dwarf of mine shall pass it for the rota, and bothered every bond and switch the cool. Of which virtue and genre is the key. When Zephyrus ate, with a sweet of breath, its spirit hawk and every heart he hath with tender practice, and the only son of hawk in the round is hollow the corpse of him, and small fools mocking never human, and slaking all the wish with open ear, so quick at them the tour of their priorities. But long and far, to go on pilgrimage, and polymers for the sake of strongest to bear the holidays and sundry longest, especially to every sheer agenda of angle honor to contribute they went on, the howly blissful march for the sake of the dam of hope, one of their sake.
Okay, that'd be great.
Middle English. I thought the 50s was perfect for her, the 50s music. Okay. So now you know who Chaucer is, right? Right. Let me, while I'm standing up here, like a tiny little slideshow. No, I haven't. I'm waiting for you guys to do it. You can download my videos, but you need QuickTime 7. And even my computer in my office doesn't have the latest update. So I haven't been able to test whether you can do it. They're all on the website. Okay, but I haven't had a chance to. It's just like, well, if they're on YouTube, the comments on those. Otherwise, you can tell me how I can fix my longer videos and turn them into YouTube, what you would do, or you can even do it yourself if you can figure out, okay, how to do it. All right? Does that make sense? Doesn't make any sense. didn't we? But then when I gave you the exam, I sent you that little page.
Yeah.
That you need more than that.
No.
Okay.
It's just you've been giving more examples and it's getting more confusing. I don't know what you're
doing. I'm not trying to confuse you. You're studying for the exam in this course. I can't say anything. The project is just you're trying to impress me a little bit, so I'm feeling good about you. Okay, all right. I want to know, let me know how much you've been looking at these things and send me a message about it. But I just don't have, the project is not the center of the course, okay? Can you not do the project at all and still do fine? Probably, okay? But it's a kind of fun thing, and you're always looking for extra credit. So, if you're a borderline person and I look at your project, then that might save you, okay? I don't know. I just don't have a. I actually had this all worked out in a sort of 10-point thing and how to grade it and everything, and I lost it on my computer when I lost my thing. I haven't been able to recreate it this semester, so sue me. All right. Let's go to another part. I'll think about that. I'll try and get it. Try and get it out to you. Okay. Good question. Transition from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. What is the Renaissance? Right? In this book, you have an introduction to the Renaissance on page 1883. I hope. So the Renaissance is this third unit we're doing in this class. It seems when you look back at the ancient literature that you're in a kind of different world. And why not? It's 300-500 years after the Middle Ages. Things have changed. Things change in the 1400s and the 1500s. That's our period of the Renaissance. Can you think of anything that changed in the world, say, in 1473 in Germany by a guy named Gutenberg? Printing's invented, okay? So right up through Chaucer, there's no books. It's all manuscript. Everything's written by hand. Suddenly, as of 1470, you can print books and you can print 1,000 copies. So things can circulate and people can read stuff, right? Within 20 years, there's plenty of places to sell those books. Anything happen in the 20 years after 1470? Make that the 22 years that you can think of. What? The Reformation happens about 40 years later, 1517. That will certainly be big. Yeah, 1492, Columbus hits America. This has impact on people's imaginations, right? Suddenly you have these whole new worlds, these new continents. And the way you exploit that is you don't sit there in a medieval monastery praying to God. You get on a ship and you cross a silly ocean and you probably die, okay? And you do it for money, right? So and you're getting rewards because there was plenty of the Spanish found, they actually found what they were looking for, which was gold, all right? So 1492, the Renaissance is the era of exploration. It's a new world. Right? it's fascinating to think of how we're at the end of this era now. I mean, the world is now one giant global village, right? The world is flat, according to Thomas Friedman. Books are sort of, you know, heading to extinction. Not as fast as the VHS tape, according to the Purdue exponent today. But, you know, people don't read, but for 500 years, the books were the source of information. Now we're, you know, we're feeling it out to see how much is going to be in books and how much is going to be in other medium. All right, so you have exploration. What was my first one? You have printing. You have the Reformation, which is really important. The Catholic Church dominated Europe as a single entity all through the Middle Ages. Now, there were plenty of problems. If you read Dante carefully, he hated Pope Boniface VIII, and who had the nerve to move the papacy out of Rome to Avignon, France. This was like outrageous. So there's plenty of corruption in the church, but it was still all there. It was still the center. It just needed to be corrected. Well, Martin Luther came along and said it just needed to be eliminated, which is a big difference, right? Martin Luther went to Rome, said, I don't like it here one bit. That's about 1510, okay? Just as many mice as when I left Germany. Nailed up the 95 theses, okay? And in 1517, and started a major break, all right? And it spread like wild, I mean, fast. Within 10 years, half of Europe is Protestant. It's just like the Islam sweep in 1622. Within 10 years, all of North Africa goes, right? And it's a product, it's a youth movement, too. All your radical Protestants are 18-year-olds to 23-year-olds. Want to get rid of the old crusty religion of their fathers. And there's a huge break, and it becomes the religion of the individual, not the corporate church. If you want to know God in the Middle Ages, you go to church, and the priest tells you all about it. He doesn't hand you a book. He doesn't say, try and read this Bible and understand it, because everybody knows it's completely meaningless. All right? I mean, you've seen how difficult it is. You need somebody to explain it to you. Well, Luther says, I'll explain it to you. And this is it. To get the church, you want to go into the Bible. So suddenly, the religious experience changes from a corporate church environment to an individual reading of the Bible. Now, this could only go so far because the Bible's got all kinds of problems. And eventually, the Protestant churches develop their own organization, too. If you're interested, I mean, that process took about 100 years. So during the English Revolution, when Cromwell was leading the English troops, and they all believed in what was called the inner light theory of revelation, that every man looked into his own heart and decided where God was. Right? Cromwell found that you couldn't run an army that way because everybody looked into his heart and said, well, I don't think I feel like fighting today. I've looked into my soul, and it seems like a really good day to get killed, so I'm staying home. Okay, so you need this corporate, you need some kind of corporate banner. But the shift from the church to the individual is one of the remarkable things about the Renaissance. Just one other thing, painting is very famous, right? You know, you can't have the Da Vinci Code without a Da Vinci. And the reason you had a Da Vinci, what was the big breakthrough in painting? What are you taught in school? Perspective. Somebody figured out around 1430, Leon Battista Alberti, how to do perspective so it looked as if the picture was three-dimensional. And it wasn't. You know, all these points and lines and vanishing points. You must have had at some point in your art class, I hope. They still teach vanishing points in eighth grade. Yeah, so suddenly, painting is, there hadn't been painting that was really exquisite since Rome, right? And the other arts tended to flourish too, particularly, and the one that's so remarkable is sculpture, right? There had been no sculpture since ancient Greece. The Romans only captured the Greeks. And then in 1495, and I do this just to, in case you never got this earlier, let me open my slideshow. A big, massive sculpture was produced. Well, removable drive. What? Did I lose it? Oh, it's happening. Cancel? Oh, I can't. Oh. F. Ah. Good man. All right, here we go. So, let's put it on the. So what's that? Essentially, you could argue the single greatest work of art in the history of the world. I mean, and it stands there in Florence. And it was sculpted by Michelangelo in 1495 out of a single piece of marble 9 feet high, okay, that already had a bad cut in it right here. And the block was actually this way, so he had to conceive the statue and then turn it up straight. So the pedestal he had to cut like that, and that you got the hip angle because some guy put a saw blade right through a piece of marble. All right, he's 25 years old. And everybody looks at this and they go, it's 1495, right? News is coming that they've just discovered a whole new world. Columbus has come back, right? And the Florentines are wondering what their place in this world is. And they're under enormous pressure from the Pope and everybody else. And they see themselves as the small, powerful intellectual state because they had, hey, we had Dante, we had Petrarch, we had Boccaccio. We're important. We're David against Goliath. Okay? So they identify with the David, the little guy. See, he's in the act of, you know, he's gonna throw a stone. He's got a sling over his shoulder, and hidden in his hand is a rock. Okay? And he doesn't even have to move, he's just gonna, right? And Goliath is going, alright? So the little guy, but it's a big statue, right? And it's just, if you ever, when you get to Florence, you drop all else and you go see this thing because it's just unbelievable. And it's different from every angle. It's nude. Michelangelo was, you know, this is the individual, the body counts, right? This is the guy who's been reading his Boccaccio. We're in a new world, right? And, of course, 50 years later, the popes cover up all his statues and his paintings and everything else, but it's still the great work of art. Yeah? Yeah. I actually have a picture from below, which doesn't make your point, which is absolutely valid. This picture sort of exaggerates it, but you're absolutely right. The amazing thing is that it was meant to be looked from below, but you can look from all angles. This just freaks people out. There is no utilitarian value to that. It was definitely to be looked at this way, but it looks perfect if you look from the top down, which no one was ever supposed to do. But the artist, it's the art. He's doing, God's looking down as far as he's concerned. It better be good from all directions. So it's really remarkable that way. There's a large hand. I just pulled these off the internet last night. So there's your bottom-up perspective, okay? And his expression changes from different sides. Sometimes he's angry, sometimes he's scared. Depends really where you stand with this thing. I think that's about all. There's a one from the back. There's even more extreme view. But I just bring it in there just to drive home my point that we have this transition in the Renaissance to the individual, and we have a number of other transition moments. And this is as good a symbol of that as anything. I'll leave it up there. So if we go back to 1883, you see on the second paragraph a discussion of Renaissance writers, in particular Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales, talking about characters. Right, now, I'm not going to take you through a Canterbury Tale, but I highly recommend for extra credit, if you want to write it, and I'll give you places on the final exam for extra credit. That's what I'm doing, right? But that's why I want you to pay attention to what I'm talking about now. So the Miller's Tale in your story is, in your book, is a story by Chaucer, but instead of just giving us the characters, he starts describing the characters. I suppose I should give you a more exact reference. Why don't you turn to page 1719. There, this is the Miller's Tale. It's about an old man, an old oaf, okay? And he runs a house, and he's got a young student who lives with him who's taking a room in his house, okay? Are you with me on 1719, the Miller's Tale? And so we know that the guy's an old guy. So he's sort of like the father in the Boccaccio story. He's going to get cuckolded. Somebody's going to sleep with his wife. And it's probably going to be the young student who's taking a room, right? So we get the student described on the next page, 1720. He was known as Handy Nicholas, this student. Handy Nicholas, which means he was fast with his hands, okay? Well-versed in love, he knew how to be prudent, going about unnoticed, sly and sure, and looks no girl was ever more demure. Lodged at this carpenter's, he lived alone. He had a room there that he made his own, festooned with herbs, and he was sweet himself as licorice or ginger. On a shelf above his bed's head, neatly stowed apart, he kept the trappings and went with his art, his astrolabe, his books, among the rest, thick ones and thin ones, his almagest, and the counters for his abacus as well. Over his cupboard a red curtain fell, and up above a pretty zither lay, on which at night so sweetly would he play, that with the music the whole world would ring, Angelus to the Virgin he would sing. So he had his guitar. He's got his room, he's got his guitar, right? Worries about how he looks. Reads books about love, that's the second line, well versed in love. And then we get to the carpenter's wife described. This carpenter, this old oaf, had newly wed a wife and loved her better than he loved his life. He was jealous, for she was 18 in age. Picture him, 47, okay. Got enough money, right, made the deal, got married. He tried to keep her close as in a cage, for she was wild and young, and old was he. And guessed that he might smack of cuckoldry. A cuckold is a man whose wife has an affair. So it's what's called a June-December marriage, right? He's December, old and cold, and she's June, young and hot, right? And Chaucer then makes his editorial comment. His ignorant wince had never chanced to strike on Cato's word that man should wed his like. Men ought to wed where their conditions point. For youth and age are often out of joint. And then you get her description. Fair was this young woman was, her body trim as any mink. She's a real vixen, right? All right, I'll leave that one to you to look at so we can get on to some other stuff. I wanted to jump back because I cut the Chanson de Roland, the Song of Roland, which is a medieval story, but I want to mention it because it's important, but it was just too long. And I'll put something on, place on the final exam. If you read a bit, you can get it. But when the French went on the Crusades to the Holy Land, right? The first Crusade was 1096. So that the Europeans got together, they got an army, and they sailed. They basically walked to Italy and needed to jump ship for modern Israel, okay, or Palestine, right? They went there, and in 1096, the First Crusade conquered Jerusalem, killed everybody in the town. They had the records, blood up to the horses, fetlocks. Okay. But while they're there, you have the clash of cultures. You have Islamic, this was a major battle between Christian Europe and Islamic Middle East. The people in Jerusalem, there were Jews there, but they weren't the main action because they were not armed. But you had an Islamic society, and this was a big clash, right? And the Christians win. So you have Europe defining itself as early as 1100 against the Islamic Middle East. And it's been going on for 1,000 years ever since. And to not know the history is pretty weird, so we'll just mention it. Stories then would pick up this theme because, you know, the French, the Christians, the Westerns are the good guys, and the cowboys and the Indians are the Middle East. And the great story of this, that tells of this conflict, is called the Song of Roland, written in French. And that's what we have here on page, the introduction starts on page 1247. But this particular story was clearly told by the French soldiers who went over to the Middle East. But it's actually about an action much earlier in history. It's about the time that Charlemagne resisted, according to legend, resisted the final incursions of the forces of Islam who came up through Spain. And got into France and were stopped at the Battle of Tours, actually by Charlemagne's grandfather, in 1740. And that's as far as Islam ever got in Western Europe. It was a big battle in 740 by Charlemagne's grandfather. And the force of, otherwise you'd all be Islamic, okay? I mean, it was that close. And they got, there were many battles in Vienna for 1,000 years. But that, in Western Europe, that's as far as it got. So this is a big event. And Charlemagne used to get the credit for it because nobody had ever heard of his father. And Charlemagne was a real person. He put together a battle against the French. So this Song of Roland is about, there's a line in it which I wasn't able to find, but it says really bluntly the ideology. Christians are good, pagans, that's the word they use for Muslims, pagans are bad. You can't get any more stark than that, right? Of course, like any great poem, the poem undercuts it, and in the Christian camp there are traitors, right? Bad people. So we see plenty of evil Christians, and we tend to see, when we see the pagans in action, they're actually pretty good people, right? That's as far as I'm going to go with this story. This story was incredibly powerful for 400 years. It was retold in French, and then it was retold in Italian. And the other author I put on your reading list, which we don't have time for, much to my distress, is a guy named Ariosto. Okay? And Ariosto, in 1519, okay, tells a story about a guy named Orlando. Okay? Which is, Orlando is just the Italian form of the French name Roland, Roland. You make it Italian, it becomes Orlando, okay? They put the O in the front. Are you with me on that? But it's still the same story as the Chanson de Roland, which Roland in the French story is the number one knight fighting for Charlemagne, okay, against Islam. Now, they actually fight in Spain in the Pyrenees Mountains, and the story is that Roland goes in, and Charlemagne goes in, and he's retreating, and Roland is leading his rear guard through the passes of the Pyrenees, okay? And he's attacked by stray Islamic forces who have been clued into his whereabouts because there's a traitor in the French camp, and Roland is killed, He dies. So that's what the poem. He dies defending Charlemagne's rear guard as they come through. And as he dies, he blows his horn. And 20 miles away across the mountains, Charlemagne hears the horn. And he says, oh my God, Roland must be dead. Because he's such an egoist, such a brave knight. He would never, ever call for help until it was too late. So they hear the horn, they know the guy's dead. The angels come down, they fly Roland up to heaven. Because he's died a martyr in the Christian cause. Right? Christians are right, pagans are wrong. That's the story. Very popular. Well, by the time you get to the Italian Renaissance, things are a lot different. The Crusades have come and gone, the Crusaders have come back. And Ariosto tells the story about now Orlando, who's still the number one knight for Charlemagne, but he has, in a story earlier by a guy named Boiardo, who I happen to translate, who I really push, but I don't have time to tell you about. He's not defending Christianity. He's running around after a girl named Angelica. Okay, so we can just feel the shift, right, from the religious to the sort of chasing girls topic that we see in Boccaccio. So Orlando's chasing after Angelica, who comes from China or something, way out there in the east, and he's looking for her. But the point I want to make is that in the middle of this story, Ariosto adds a note of tolerance for other societies that's completely missing in the Middle Ages. And that comes on page 1967. All right? And this is a wonderful moment. Because Ariosto is much more of a thinker than whoever wrote the Song of Roland. Page 1967. Well, it turns out Angelica is so beautiful, there are at least 25 guys chasing after her. And every time they run into each other, they have to fight, like knights do. They joust, they whack each other on the head. And here's two guys named Rinaldo and Ferragutto. They're both fighting for her, and while they fight for her, she runs away. And they see her run away and say, look, why are we beating each other up? This is nuts, because like, one of us is going to win, but the girl, she's gone. Why don't we track her down first, and then when we find her, then we can kill each other. Okay. And Ariosto goes, ain't this the way it should be? Okay, and this is down about 10 lines up in the last paragraph. Here they were, rivals of different faiths, because Ferragutto is Islamic, and Orlando is the Christian. Rivals of different faiths. And they still ached all over from the cruel and vicious blows they had dealt each other. Still, off they went together in mutual trust, on the same horse, I might add. Okay. Through the dark woods and crooked paths. You with me? Page 1967. About 8 lines up. Here they were, of different faiths. Isn't this glorious? Right? Oh, the line, the key line, great was the goodness of the knights of old. O gran bontà dei cavalieri antichi. Lousy translation, you know. O gran bontà, oh great goodness of the ancient knights of old, or whatever you want to call it. Unbelievable. Back then, Ariosto says, people of different faiths could get along. And the implication is, I wish they could do it today. 1516 when he's writing. Okay? So there's always people of goodwill, so that's a big moment. Let's take a look at another key shift from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance on page 1901. These are the highlights of ancient literature. Any of you guys watch the Tour de France? Ever? Remember Lance Armstrong? I see, like, ancient history. Okay. This is a piece by a guy named Francis Petrarch. It's the name I want you to know. You don't have to know the name. We don't have to know a lot here. Right? Dante wrote in Florence. Boccaccio wrote in Florence. And between them, there was this guy named Petrarch. Dante wrote an epic. Boccaccio wrote these sort of dirty short stories we're reading. He also wrote poems. But Petrarch invented modern poetry. On Thursday, I'm going to take you through a few sonnets and some Shakespeare sonnet and look at some of these poems and talk to you a little bit about the growth of poetry. But it was really Petrarch who was the first guy. He wasn't the first, but he was the most famous one who put his lady on a pedestal and wrote poems about her. As Dante, you wouldn't say Beatrice is on a pedestal. She was up in heaven. Petrarch's Laura was right here on earth, okay? And he was writing about her. Now, he really straddles the Middle Ages and the Renaissance because he's a very religious person, but he's also a character, too. And he really invents the whole notion of putting that woman on a pedestal and saying, you are my goddess. I adore you, Laura. And he calls her Laura because she represents, if he can describe her, she represents his poetic gift. His ability to describe her in words would make him the poet laureate. Do you remember the laurel leaf that when Daphne was turned into the laurel tree and Apollo made, that was Apollo was the god of poetry. So Petrarch sees that and says, that's poetry, women are the same thing, okay? And we don't even know if Laura existed, but she certainly was the subject of about 400 of the most famous love poems of all time, which had enormous influence on later literature. Well, he also, besides writing these poems, which I'll talk about on Thursday, talked about himself in ways that lead us into Montaigne, who's the real subject for Thursday. That kind of piercing of the interior that is really, we only have Augustine for anything similar. And in this passage, starting on 1897, it's the famous ascent of Mount Ventoux, the windy mountain in southern France. And Petrarch goes up there, and he looks out, and he's the first guy in history to climb a mountain and say, what a beautiful view. No Roman would do this. It made no sense. You go to Rome where there's food, parties, prostitutes, but who the hell goes up a mountain? Petrarch's the first guy because it's the view and it's a religious experience. So he attaches his religious experience to a worldly experience. And he does it in this very complicated little passage, which I think you should read. I'll put it on the additional list. And the key is page 1901. He gets up the mountain, and he's feeling that the view is symbolic of his own interior state. In other words, to look out over from an alp in the valleys is like looking into his own soul. And to get the point across, he happens to bring a copy of St. Augustine's Confessions up there with him, right? And he looks into it, and he says, he starts to equate finding God with finding himself. And that's a very Renaissance notion, the shift from the corporate to the self. So right in the middle of the paragraph there, he says, I was abashed at asking my brother not to annoy me, I closed the book, angry with myself, that I should still be admiring earthly things who might long ago have learned from even the pagan philosophers that nothing is wonderful but the soul, when great itself finds nothing great outside itself. Then in truth, I was satisfied I had seen enough of the mountain. I turned my inward eye upon myself, and from that time not a syllable fell from my lips. He has the sublime experience just thinking about himself, right? Big shift. You can't have a mountain without this. Well, I'll leave you at that just to remind you. Do you remember the fifth time Armstrong won the Tour de France? He beat Jan Ulrich. He just killed him on the 14th day going up Mount Ventoux. Right? And it was so amazing. I mean, this had nothing to do with anything, but it was so amazing. And they were wondering about the drugs because, I mean, Ulrich was up on his toes, you know, like sweating. It's going like this, you know. And they're 5 hours into it, and Armstrong goes past him sitting down. You know? Unbelievable. Same place. Yes, I did. Got you right here.
Brianne?
Haley?
Anna.
Sorry. That's a good. Lara?
Yeah.
Seminar.
Thank you.
Study hard on the final.
I have a question. About for the final paper, I don't know what to write about. So, what should I do?
You? By Thursday, just pick two work stories, pages, from different authors. Two things you're interested in. And you're going to do a comparison of them. Just talk about them.
So would you like something like the Middle Ages and the Renaissance?
Pick one from the Middle Ages. Pick a scene, a moment, a page, a line. 100 lines from Dante compared to anything I've been going over. It helps if you do the picking and then I help you figure out what to do with it.
Okay.
Find something you're interested in that you read and you thought it was kind of cool.
Okay.
Because you're the one that has to sit there and think about it. All right? And then see me on Thursday.
Okay.
All right?
But are you doing assignment? Like, yeah. If you get, say 12 people comment, 7 bonus points. Do you get more for every person?
Yeah, I take it into, but I'm not making a 10 would be plenty. I wouldn't go to 12.
Yeah. Maximum you can get.
Five. The assignment said find 5 people, look at 5 different.
Well, then you also said there's more for more. Too.
Right. So 1 more would be a little more, and 2 more would be 12 is
That's the maximum. I've got people who do one.
It depends what you're going for, Andrew. I don't know if I can take you up to. I can't take you up to an A.
Well, I know on
a basis of extra credit here.
Okay. I
don't know if I can get you up to a B either. So, I think in class we said 10 was seemed to be worthy of notice.
10 people.
Yeah, but this is not your time. This is supposed to be fun and stuff, and it's a little bonus. But your time is best spent reading the stuff and writing the paper and. Okay. I would use it just as a way to get yourself to watch these things. All right. The project is not the big centerpiece.
Oh, no,
okay. Right. Other classes it might be. It's just in this one's not. Okay. Yeah. But can't hurt. Possibly. Look, but the way it kicks in, if you're very deep into a, I can't raise you 10 points,
right,
but if you're on a board,
you're a little bit more than 5.
Yeah, but I would even that. You're better off doing extra on the. Yeah, I should probably just cancel the project. But I want people to. This gives you another reason for looking at these videos.
It's
too
much over. It's really
I can't.
What you're
yeah, I think it is too.
I'm not trying to overlap.
Because I want you to watch. I just find a way to get you to watch these tapes.
Yeah.
Because that stuff is always showing up on the exams.
It doesn't have to be a big project. You just look at what people think about the video, right? I mean, you can
5 emails?
Okay, I was more than I thought it was.
No.
Well, you kind of scare people because you're pretty picky, so.
I am, but in the exams. All right. So
I think they're kind of nervous because you say it to be completely honest. I wanted to make
Well, if there's no grade on the project, how can I be picky? That's the thing. It's a kind of pass, but you do it or you don't. I want you to do something.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Just do something.
Okay.